Welcome to Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum. I'm Zoe Gilbert, and for this masterclass, I'm interviewing award-winning short story writer Adam Marek. Adam is the author of two short story collections, Instruction Manual for Swallowing and The Stone Thrower, both published by Comma Press. He won the 2011 Arts Foundation Short Story Fellowship and was shortlisted for the inaugural Sunday Times EFG Short Story Award and the Edge Hill Short Story Prize. His stories have appeared on BBC Radio 4 and in many magazines and anthologies, including Prospect and the Sunday Times magazine, and recently, the Penguin Book of the British Short Story. Hi Adam, welcome to Thresholds.
Hi there Zoe, thanks.
So I looked on your website before this interview and saw that you say you write about absurd, futuristic and fantastical things colliding with everyday life. But I also noticed that your editor, Ra Page at Comma Press, describes your work as surreal, which feels slightly different to me, and I wondered if you distinguish between the fantastic and the surreal.
There is, for me, a distinction between the fantastic and the surreal, for sure. The fantastic conjures images of things that aren't real, so monsters and zombies and otherworldly things, creeping into everyday life. Whereas surrealism, I think, involves ordinary everyday things, but out of context. So Salvador Dali's lobster on a telephone. Lobsters and telephones are both ordinary things, but put together, that's surrealism. A zombie talking on the telephone, that's the fantastic.
So you'd put yourself firmly in the camp of fantastical fiction writers rather than the surreal?
Yeah, definitely.
And what do you think set you on that path? What have your influences been from the beginning?
I think the imagery and the setups that I like to use have all come from the stuff that I was reading and watching as a kid. So I read lots of fantasy and Tolkien and Maurice Sendak, and I was watching lots of science fiction movies, especially the old 50s B movies, aliens in rubber suited aliens and alien invasions. And I grew up in a household that was full of horror books as well, so My mum and my aunt and my nan were all massive horror fans, and so all the houses that I spent my childhood in were full of James Herbert and Stephen King and Dean Koontz. So I was reading that kind of stuff at a very early age as well. I suppose it's populated my imagination with those kinds of images. But the fantastical element, so combining those or using them rather to talk about everyday things, everyday experiences. The big moment was the first time I read Kafka's Metamorphosis, and it was a proper light bulb moment for me, a eureka moment. I was in the bath when I read it as well. And you know, reading about this character, he wakes up transformed into a giant bug, but then, you know, why he's a bug or is never gone into in the story. That's not the question. Mm-hmm. It's really about how his family treat him and how he feels about himself once he's turned into a bug, and that's that excited me so much. It was using the device of something very fantasy based to talk about something very real. You could swap out the bugginess and just have him wake up with some kind of horrible disease, and all the elements of the story would still work, but we look at it through the prism of Gregor Samsa's bugginess, which makes it more...
Maybe that the bugginess to me is a horror element. It's a form of body horror, maybe. Mm. And yet that's an unequivocally literary story,
yeah.
Very different from the kind of horror that you grew up reading at home, or kind of B-movie, alien, nasty stuff.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of aesthetic that's different between those two things, and also to me, something really structurally different, like the difference between the Stephen King story and the Kafka story, is there's way more plot going on in Stephen King. So where would you place yourself on that scale? Are you drawn towards plot and quite structured stories?
A plot is really important to me. I guess I'm trying to have the best of all worlds. I really appreciate well-told plot, and when, you know, plot is very contrived, it's put together in a way to deliver a particular experience to a reader, leading up to some kind of satisfying and surprising conclusion. When it's done well, that's so hugely satisfying, and I love that in genre fiction and genre movies. And in literary fiction, sometimes, not always, but often, it's the inner life of the characters, the human interactions on a smaller scale that are the focus, and that really excites me too. I'm interested in the individual human experience, and so writing stuff within the fantastic, I think, just gives me the opportunity to have explore plot, but also look at the interior life of my characters.
Yeah, it feels like a big step away from something like an alien B movie to using aliens or other fantastical elements to really as metaphors, really, for exploring inner life, which feels like a very literary approach. But I'm interested in the way that these two genres, if you like, have become a little bit more blended, or maybe people are quite keen to find categories in between, sort of hard sci-fi and pure literary fiction, and we're getting categories popping up like slipstream or the new weird. Mm-hmm. What do you think of these labels? Do you think they're helpful?
Labels are helpful for booksellers and book buyers. You know, they help you identify the kind of things that you want to read, and when you have a book out, it has to sit on a physical shelf in a shop somewhere, or it has to have a tag on an online shop. So I think, you know, those kinds of categories have a use, but also in the process of book buying and selling. But the writers who are really interesting, who really interest me, are people whose books are hard to categorize, because they fit between they fall into the cracks in between. So people like J.G. Ballard, who, you know, wrote some very straight sci-fi stories, and then some very literary stories, and then the whole bunch of stuff that sits in between it. And Karen Russell, who's writing stories about human experience and often teenagers going through kind of coming of age stage of life, but in worlds with giant crabs and ghosts, and
so. Yeah, she feels very well, she feels influenced by similar kind of fantastical sources to you in some ways, this sort of this like B movie, the slightly grittier side of culture that comes through. And she has peculiar theme parks, doesn't she, like an alligator theme park and yeah, that kind of stuff. I heard her talking in an interview actually about how when she was a kid reading, she would have to hide the fact that she was reading fantasy fiction because it just wasn't cool then, and you'd get told off for it. But it's clearly coming out in what she chooses to write about in her very literary career. Do you relate to that?
Oh God, yeah, absolutely. I had a very similar experience. So when I was a kid, I was reading lots of fantasy, Dungeons and Dragons kinds of things, and I had one of the years at school, we had a project that ran across a few terms where we got to write a novel. I mean, it was a novella length thing really, but I wanted to write a fantasy book, pure fantasy, about a boy who finds out his parents are dragons. And and when I went and told my teacher that was what I wanted to write, she said, no, you have to write something serious and normal and everyday. And I was furious, and I said, no, I really, really want to write this book. This is why excites me. And so she said, fine, go talk to the the head of English, and so I went and talked to him and said exactly the same thing again, and argued with him for a good long while. And he said, fine, you can write a fantasy book, but I'm going to mark you down for it. So I wrote the book, and he did mark me down for it. But I got to write what I wanted to.
Did he know what he started, what you ended up writing later.
But there was that sense of, you know, being interested in the aesthetic of a fantasy as being something shameful or childish. There's a stage where, you know, when you're a particular age, a teacher or a parent might say, all right, you know, this is the perfect age for you to read The Hobbit. But then if you pick it up at 15 to read in a class, the teacher might say, no, it's you should have moved beyond that. It's time to put away your wizards. you know, here's some proper fiction for you to read now. And I just think that's so unfair, because, you know, the core of all fiction is exploring the human experience, and whether you do that in the context of a very realistic school environment or a combat situation, or you do it on Mars, or you do it in a swamp full of ghosts, it doesn't matter. These are that's the dressing for the actual skeleton of the story, the meat. It doesn't matter where you, how you dress it up and how you explore it, or rather it does matter how you dress it up, because that's the prism that you look at the real heart of the story from. But I just think it's so narrow to judge something on the aesthetics that sits around the actual heart of the story.
So the fact that we're living in an age when actually fantasy, science fiction and sort of Game of Thrones style fantasy are really taking over popular culture, and they are now cool, and everyone watches Stranger Things and everyone watches Game of Thrones, probably except me. they've become acceptable and mainstream, and that seems to me to be happening at the same time as we're seeing writers like you, Karen Russell, you already mentioned, George Saunders, perhaps. I think of Kelly Link as well, who's really into literary zombies, who are also really exploring fantastical tropes in literary fiction, and particularly in short stories. Do you think these are two completely separate sort of trends, or do you think there's a link there?
I think the bridge into sort of making fantasy acceptable and unshameful has been film and TV. There's been some, you know, really big big movies, the Lord of the Rings trilogy that Peter Jackson made, and then Game of Thrones, and I think it's always been acceptable to watch fantasy, but reading it is very different. Yeah. So someone will quite happily go and watch the new Spider-Man movie and not even question whether that's age appropriate for them, because it's a movie, it's fine. But that same person wouldn't get out a Spider-Man graphic novel and read it on the tube. There'd be a sense of shame, almost as if reading has to be more of an intellectual pursuit. It's really bizarre. I don't know why that is, but because recently, in my opinion anyway, because you've had some really exceptionally successful series like Game of Thrones and like Stranger Things, it's made people more open to those kinds of worlds. So it's a great time for fantasy and sci-fi. And at the moment, I haven't been to see it yet, but there's a big exhibition on at the Barbican about history of science fiction. And, you know, at the same time at the Science Museum, there's a big robots exhibition, you know, artistic or sort of kind of high art venues looking at, you know, wanting to get people excited in what they do, and using fantasy and science fiction and the unknown as a way to reach and excite people, to create that sense of wonder. I think that's the most that's the thing. It's like, I think the sense of wonder and is being appreciated a lot more now, finally.
Yeah, now that we're seeing kind of constant discussion about AI in particular, robotics and space exploration and putting a colony on Mars and all of these things that were firmly in the realm of sci-fi and fantasy are actually being served up to us in the news now.
Yeah.
Which is a big shift from those more nostalgic sources that have probably influenced you from childhood. And I know you're still interested by and excited by kind of space exploration and AI and robotics, and they're themes that have come through in some of your more recent stories. I wanted to ask you about the one that was on Radio 4 a few weeks ago called Companions, which is from the point of view of a guy who's having a bit of trouble at home with his robot companion. Can you explain where the idea came from and how you use it to tell us something about this very human character?
Where did that story start? I think I've been thinking for a while about how the devices that we carry around with us all the time allow us to manipulate our experience of the world. We don't ever have to be bored. If we don't want something in our lives, we can choose to filter it out. Our news we can filter it so we only get the stuff that really excites us. And thinking about following that forward, that level of control of experience, how would that be if your romantic partner was an artificial creation and you didn't have to, you know, if it in an argument, say, you could just hit the off switch and then if you got to a state where you didn't ever have to experience or adapt to another human being, if it was just all within your control, would that be satisfying? Or actually would you very soon start to think that it's realized that it's the uniqueness and the unpredictability of sharing a life with another human being that's actually the exciting thing? And it's and so if you were creating an artificial companion, would to make it believable and realistic, would it then have to surprise you and not follow your demands and, you know, have its own agency? And then how is that different from a real person? How do you, where are the levels? And so I was just interested in exploring that and how it might affect a person, and then and especially what would happen if the kind of questions that a person having a relationship with an artificial companion might ask themselves, such as, you know, if I were to not me personally, if one were to have a relationship with an artificial companion, would they become so entrenched in a particular way of being with someone else that they then become completely incompatible with real human beings? And what a dangerous and hideous thing that would be. So these are the questions that the character is asking himself in the story.
Yeah, I really picked up on the main character's fear that actually without ever having to deal with any sort of kickback from this robot, that he could effectively turn into a tyrant, a kind of monster, and that's what he's really afraid of. And
yeah.
I thought that sounded like a real concern if anyone was ever to find themselves in that situation, but also reflects on the bigger debate that we're having at the moment about morality and ethics around AI, where it puts us as the creators and controllers of that. Because if you are effectively a slave owner of sorts over an AI, then you could easily become a tyrant. Or do we program them not to challenge us? Or do we create something that thinks independently and risk the kickback from them? And all of that debate is encapsulated in your story, which also manages to go off on another imaginative flight as the character throughout the story is consulting his dead grandma in his head about what he should do. So ghosts and robots in one story. And I wanted to ask you about creating metaphors in stories, because mostly the fantastical elements in your stories are providing a metaphor for something, and how the metaphor is working in that story. Like, what does ghostly grandma represent, maybe, as well as the robotic companion?
In that particular story, it's that he's having an imaginary conversation. It's that it's all from within him. It's not real. It's not another human interaction he's having. Whatever words he's imagining his grandma is saying back to him, and he finds it a big comfort, because he can, you know, he's known his grandma, even though she's dead now. He knew her for long enough that he can imagine the kinds of things that she might say, but still they're going through the filter of him, and he's relating a problem that he's having with an artificial life form. It just excites me, the idea that this character is just so, is insular the right word? He's got himself in a situation where he's interacting with two things that aren't real and tying himself in knots, and he's never going to get anywhere with it, because he's only kind of interacting with himself. And I think that's the dangerous path that kind of setup might throw people down, is that we're just generating our own problems and answering our own questions, and not doing the human interaction thing that means we all get, you know, actual different perspectives, because, you know, that's how we learn about the world, and you know, what a relief it is to get outside of our own heads and see the world through other people's eyes.
That's really interesting that you bring up his issue being one of not getting different perspectives and really trying to see from someone else's point of view, because the other story of yours I wanted to ask you about was the one that came out in the Comma Press anthology very recently, Thought X, which Fiction and Hypotheticals is the subtitle, and it's all stories written by writers who've talked to a scientist or a philosopher to explore some kind of philosophical or scientific paradox, I suppose. And in your story for Thought X, you also explore perspectives that are being made radically different through a time shift to do with space travel, which I will let you explain in more detail. But there's a theme that comes up there again. So I wondered whether you could talk about whether you started with that idea of different perspectives and those clashing, or whether you started with the central idea of travelling at light speed, and then thought about what that could stand for, be a metaphor for.
Okay. I was commissioned to write the story by Rob Page at Comma Press. This is the latest of their science into fiction books. They've done about six now, where they pair up a writer with a scientist. You get to spend a conversation over the phone for an hour, or sometimes I've spent a whole day with a scientist looking at them and chatting about their work. This particular story, the thought experiment, was the twin paradox, which is, if you've got twins and you stick one of them into a spaceship and fly them away from the Earth at close to the speed of light, for a period of time, when they come back, they will be, because of the time dilation effects of traveling at light speed, they will have aged less than the twin back on Earth. So if they travel for several months or a year, say, at close to the speed of light, when they come back, they might find actually 10 years has passed for the twin on the Earth, and so there's this big difference. And
it's a little bit like a fairy tale. Yeah. You go away for a few days and it turns out to have been you.
Yeah, exactly. And so for this story, I didn't want to write a story where one twin goes away and comes back and they just have the horror of seeing themselves in what they're going to look like in 10 years time, and for the other twin thinking, oh, you look so young. That didn't excite me. So I wanted to look at it on a really smaller scale, and I'm writing a lot about space at the moment, and so I knew that's why I picked that idea, because it seemed like a good opportunity to write a story set in space. So in this story, there is a guy who has a job doing like short shuttle runs to a deep spaceship in a light speed kind of bullets shaped spaceship that travels at close to the speed of light, because he's got vast distances to travel. In his experience, he's only away for a couple of days at a time, but every time he comes back, a much longer time has passed for his family, who are living with him on the space station. And I just thought that would be a really great, you know, conflict is at the heart of all the story. And I thought that, and I like writing about family dynamics and relationships especially. And so I thought that would be a good way of using the twin paradox to, you know, create conflict within a family, because they're both experiencing time in a very different way. So I started with wanting to write about space, write about light speed travel, because I had that brief, and then just looked for, you know, as I always do with these when I get briefs from Ra, is look for the conflict. How could this go wrong? How could this really rub people up the wrong way? How could this be distressing? And what would happen?
So is that a sort of almost a technique or a method that you've developed over years of writing short stories, of choosing the thing or an image or an idea that you want to be central, or your setting of space, and then looking for ways to introduce conflict to them? Or indeed find metaphorical meaning in them and do it sort of that way round.
I almost always start with the imagery, with the fantastical conceit. So for example, Meaty's Boys, a story about a guy who works in a restaurant for zombies. The idea came, I had a really clear image of a zombie tapping its foot to Hey Jude in a zombie restaurant, and the story all grew out of that. And it was after, or kind of halfway through writing that draft, or maybe even at the end of the first draft, I thought, what's the story really about? And I realized it was about, at the heart of it, was about peer pressure. It's about someone being put in a situation that where they just feel it's inescapable, even, and they're forced to do something horrific against their own will because they can't see a way out of it. So I don't ever start off thinking, I want to write a story about peer pressure, and then think, how can I do that, and then have
with zombies.
It never works that way around. I start with the weirdness, with the odd fantastical conceit, and then you know, try and employ my unconscious brain as much as possible and just getting a very loose first draft out, and then looking at it and analysing it and thinking, okay, what's really going on here? What's the story about? How can I use this setup to talk about something that interests me or is important to me?
And do you like to leave the interpretation of what a story is really about, or if whether or not there's a message in there at all, ambiguous for your readers? Or do you like to be quite clear? Like, would you like every reader of Meaty's Boys to be able to look beyond this amazing, wondrous, actually, kind of setup of watching these young kids working at this restaurant, having to go out hunting for bodies, like racing through derelict landscapes, listening to loud music on their headphones, and it's really vivid and it's really engaging. But do you want all your readers to look beyond that and think, aha, this is really a story about peer pressure?
No, I don't. The most important thing is that the story is entertaining. I think of myself as an entertainer, and as long as the reader enjoys it on one level, that's fine. And I'm not, I think the worst thing a writer can do is think, right, this is the moral of the story that I want to tell people. It's just, you know, it's a terrible way into thinking about fiction, but it's important that it has, you know, fiction is a way of me exploring how I feel about things, how and ideas about the world, and whether they're right or wrong. It's a way of exploring human experience, my own experience, and so it's not like I'm embedding some moral in it that I expect everyone to get. It doesn't, and often it doesn't matter. Sometimes I bury it so deep, it's just there, like you probably couldn't unpick it. I like there to be, I just think having a reason for the story beyond pure entertainment, having it be an exploration of some kind of human difficulty or conflict, gives the story depth, I guess. Or and it, I like to leave it open to interpretation. You know, sometimes the thing that I thought a story was about won't. Someone else will think, oh no, actually, I thought this was a story about something else entirely, and that's great, because you know, I think most writers, if not all writers, you know, our unconscious minds are the thing that does the really clever work. We can scheme and plot and contrive, but it's the unconscious mind that puts the surprises on the page that you know are delightful when they have, you know, in that process of writing. It's a great experience when suddenly something comes out on the page and you think, where did that come from? What's that about? And start questioning it.
So do you have a method or any advice to other writers about how to make sure you let that happen, how to ensure that you let your subconscious get to the page and you can surprise yourself?
Yeah, I think when you're writing a first draft, you should write it as long and as loosely as you possibly can, and then look at and don't analyze what you're doing, and until you finish the first draft, and then look at it. I think the first draft should just feel like play, and you should be completely open to failure, for it not to make sense, and then go in afterwards after that first draft's finished and think, what's important here, what's the conflict, who are my characters, you know, why everything on the page at that after the first draft has to justify its existence, and that's the part where I start to shape things. I'll occasionally plan a story out in advance, but mostly I like to write a first draft without a plan, and then very heavily plan it in the subsequent drafts after that. I think trusting your unconscious is a really important skill, and just it's like listening to it and giving it a forum. So I'll often in notebooks, but often first thing in the morning, I'll just write a stream of consciousness of just burble whatever goes through my brain, put it on the page just to exercise that sense of not having full control. It's the feeling when you're writing that suddenly you're rolling downhill and you're freewheeling, and it's almost like generating it itself. I think when you have that experience, then you know you've given your unconscious the steering wheel for a time. And also, you know, that experience where you're searching for an idea or you're searching for a solution, and you're doing something completely different. You're washing up or going for a walk or wherever it is, and then the idea pops into your head. Your unconscious has been working on that in the background, and it knew it was important to you, and so it's been busily beavering away, and then it delivers the goods. And I think we should be encouraging our unconscious minds and rewarding them for their for their efforts. And so when ideas come, whatever they are, even if your unconscious delivers a real hopeless turd of an idea and you just think this is never going to get written, I write it down anyway. I write down all my stupid ideas, and I have lots of them, because I think to do the opposite, to only write down, to, if you know, every time your unconscious delivers something to you, if you say nope, that's no good, that's not going to win me a prize, that's not going to get published, my editor's going to hate that, and then bat it away. Then you kind of, you make your unconscious timid and shut it down, and then it becomes shamed in the same way that I was shamed for lacking fantasy as a schoolboy. And so I encourage my unconscious by just being grateful for everything it throws up and putting it down on it in a notebook. And out of the, you know, out of 50 thoughts or ideas that I have, when I go back through my notebook, then I'll just cherry pick the ones that I know will work as a piece of fiction that excite me, and then I work with those, and then just gently ignore the turdy ones.
I've talked to you before about the idea of putting together two contrasting ideas or images in order to build a story, and that this is a technique that you sometimes like to use, of choosing two things that do not go together. Mm. The story of yours that springs to mind is testicular cancer and the behemoth as being two things that do not go together, but they do in the story. Is that something you do when you go through your ideas or your notes? Do you look for things that you actually can't see making a story and then deliberately play with them?
Yeah, if I've got an idea that I'm excited about but doesn't feel like it's going to work, it hasn't got life in it yet, then it's usually because the companion idea hasn't come along yet, and it might take it might take a couple of hours of brainstorming to find that, or looking through other notebooks to find the combination that will spark life into the thing. And other times an idea might just be kind of percolating at the back of my head for years, and then I'll go and see an exhibition, or I'll see a poster on the underground or something, and I'll just think, if that combined with the other thing, that would really work. That's something exciting. And I guess it's like a the gambling machines with the, where you pull
fruit machine,
yeah, where I've got different wheels spinning, and I've got like a wheel of my constant preoccupations, which are, you know, technology and robots and other worlds and mutants, and I've got other wheels going about, which are things that I just experience every day, human interactions, everyday life, or, you know, exhibitions that I go to, and you know, at some point a combination of things will click into place, and all of the coins will come flying out the slot, and if it's a good moment, I trust when an idea is going to it hits my wonder button, and then I know that I've got that it's worth spending some time on. So with that, with testicular cancer, that's probably the longest I've ever had an idea or an image germinating of any of my stories. So I had a recurring nightmare when I was a kid, like 4, 5, 6 years old, where I was in the house that I was living at, and I could just hear this horrific like thump, thump, thump coming, and I knew that it was a giant walking across the town, coming towards me, and I'd just hear this thump, and it would be so frightening, and I'd look out my window and I'd just hear the thump, and then suddenly just I saw the top of its head like clear the horizon. I'd wake up just absolutely dripping and terrified, and so it's that when I started writing that story, Testicular Cancer versus the Behemoth, that was the opening moment where you hear the thumping of this monster approaching in this adult man's life, the horror of the realization that he's just got a diagnosis of cancer, and so I like pairing up those two things, the idea of this huge monster literally coming into his life at the same time, that almost as a projection, an external projection of what's going on inside him. So the monster is
Yeah, absolutely, and a lot more full of wonder button hitting to read, rather than a story about the guy getting his diagnosis, and then however that messes up his day, we can really focus on the monster, and that kind of allows us actually to kind of peer between our fingers at the scary element, which is the cancer.
Yeah, and it gives him an opportunity. The thing that was important for me in that story is that he's feeling, you know, hugely emasculated and obviously terrified about this diagnosis. Suddenly he's not only does he not feel like a complete man anymore, but obviously he's going to die. And so in the monster, he has an opportunity to pick up a machine gun, go shoot the monster in the balls. And he gets to feel good about himself for a final moment before he goes. So to give him that little treat.
Aww. Well, so that we might have a final moment of positivity in this interview rather than ending on death. One of your earlier stories from your first collection, The 40-Litre Monkey, was published in the Penguin Book of the Short Story. Was it last year? Maybe the year before?
Yeah.
Which is quite an achievement, an amazing anthology to be in. It's a big 2-volume whacking great thing with British short stories from hundreds of years. How does it feel to have a story in that book?
Yeah, it was an amazing honour to have that story picked for the book. It's it goes all the way back to Daniel Defoe and up to present day, and there aren't that many living writers in there, so one of my stories was selected. We've just felt it was a huge honour. I still can't quite believe it, actually. My head swelled a little bit after that.
I think you're allowed that. Well, thank you. It's been an honour and it's been a pleasure to hear from you about your writing and get your advice. Thank you, Adam Marek.
Thanks, eh?